Hey guys, this is Laura Vandervoort. I played Kara Kent / Supergirl on Smallville, and you are listening to Always Hold On to Smallville.
Welcome to Always Hold On to Smallville. In this podcast, we talk about each and every episode of The Young Superman Show that ran from 2001 to 2011 on the WB and the CW. I'm your host, Zach Moore, but we're not talking about Smallville this week. We're talking about a film that takes place in Smallville and stars one of the stars of Smallville, Superman 3. And who better to join me to discuss Superman 3 than the man who joined me to discuss Superman 2, Mr. John Mills. What's up, John?
Hello, hello, hello. I'm pleased to be back. Thank you for welcoming me back to this fine show to discuss a film that happened.
Yes, 1983's Superman 3. What a year for film. Jaws 3, Star Wars 3, as it was known at the time.
Yes,
that's the true. Year of the threequel. What was it? Is it 2007 they say was the year of the threequel? Because you had Spider-Man 3, Shrek 3, Something else three. I don't know what the other three was.
But the thing is that, yes, everything moves in cycles.
Yes.
Time is a flat circle. The threequel will come again.
The threequel. So, Superman 3. You know, it's actually been about a year, John, since we talked about, you know, as of this recording, since we did our recording about Superman 2.
Wow. Has it been that long?
It's been a year. And, you know, we're in between seasons here on Always Hold On to Smallville. So, in order to, you know, mix up the conversation and then also give myself some more time before I rev up for the next season, we talk about the various things. And as I said last time, once they released Superman the movie, the 3-hour extended HD widescreen television cut, I was just waiting. I said, oh, great, I can't wait till they do Superman 2 and Superman 3 and maybe even Superman 4, and then that'll give me a reason to talk about these things. But apparently they're never going to do that. So we're just going to talk about them to talk about them. John, have you ever seen the TV extended cut of Superman 3?
If I have, I don't remember it. It's entirely possible and probably probable that I did because, you know, yeah, I was a kid in that era and we had 6 television stations. And so there you go. Like that, it inevitably crossed the radar, but I don't have any memory of it.
Yeah, being born in the late 80s, I have never seen the TV version of Superman 3. You know, it's extended. It was, again, one of these ideas for like, oh, let's extend it so we can have more commercials and let's put in some deleted scenes. And Frank Oz of Yoda fame makes a cameo as a brain surgeon in one scene. And just little things here or there, as I understand it. But I was hoping I could sit down and watch a, you know, HD widescreen cut of that on Blu-ray, but I guess I never will.
But see, that's kind of crazy that they wouldn't have had Frank Oz in the theatrical version, because then Frank Oz would have been in 2 blockbuster movies in 1983. How crazy is that?
One scene each.
Yeah.
So another thing about the TV version, honestly, the thing that interested me the most is it had credits that took place in space.
Mm.
And I'm like, that would restore some dignity that is perhaps missing from the introduction of Superman 3. But
yes,
we can get into that. So, you know, Superman 3, this is one I don't remember when I first saw this in its entirety. I remember when I was younger seeing it on TV, and this seems to be one of these like universal things for kids who watch this movie. I was very frightened of the cyborg at the end. I don't know why that struck me. It's so frightening, but I see that I'm not alone, because on the internet, everybody's like, oh man, what scared you as a kid? Like, oh, the cyborg from Superman 3. Perhaps just the way it's just done is very effective, like very creepy. And we can talk about that as we get into it. But that's my most visceral, like real memory of Superman 3. And then I honestly don't remember anything about it until I got the DVD set like in high school when it came on DVD. That's when I remember watching it start to finish. And because my parents had Superman 1 and 2, and that's what I would rewatch all the time. And yeah. Then 3 and 4 were like an afterthought.
Well, they should be. But no, I 3 I remembered plenty of. But yes, the cyborg scene at the end scared that like left indelible scars on my psyche, like for my whole life. And if anybody ever said Superman 3, that's immediately what I think of. Mm-hmm. Nothing else. And then like even the split Superman fighting himself is a secondary thought.
Right.
And you would think that's like the big centerpiece of the film. Yeah. But instead, it's freaky robot lady.
That's so weird how your mind works as a kid, I guess. Yeah. I don't, but it's universal. It's in our DNA somehow, because this is, if you go on Twitter, you get, or wherever, there are threads, and everyone is on the same wavelength when it comes to that about Superman 3. But, man, I guess, you know, this Superman, of course, was the first big-budget superhero movie franchise, and this is what started the impossibility of having three good ones in a row. Because as yes. flawed as Superman 2 is, and, you know, we talked it through last time you were on the show, John, and, you know, I still love it. You know, I've fallen kind of, I just was exhausted of Superman 2 with all the, like, the daughter cut, the theatrical cut, oh, you know, all that stuff. It's so much baggage. But then rediscovering it, rewatching it, you know, it kind of took me back to when I was a kid and loved it. So I've come to terms with Superman 2, and it's still very enjoyable. Superman 3 is not a good film. Let's just get that out of the way right now.
Very
you know,
true.
It's just,
very,
it's not a true. Good film. It's unfortunate that, because you see what you see, all of the negative aspects of what Richard Lester brought to Superman 2 when he replaced Richard Donner are turned up to 11 here.
Yes.
And it's like the things you like talk about in the Metropolis fight in Superman 2. It's like, well, it's cool to see them fight. But then why is there a guy talking on a phone booth that's being blown over and slapstick comedy? And
right.
That is all over the place in Superman 3, especially the opening credits, because in the theatrical version, there's no space credits. There's these weird, like, I guess, what are they trying to do, like, reference Star Wars or something? These scrolling credits?
Right. And they're not... The only thing I can possibly think is that they didn't want to pay John Williams for his theme. And so they were trying to find some way to subtly suggest Superman that you loved and get around the idea. Because I know that the Salkinds, like, their big thing was they were motivated by money, and they that was the clashes with Donner about all of these different sorts of things. And I think what you see really is exactly how key Donner was to the first Superman and even the second Superman working, is there's that Silver Age mentality brought to Superman 2, Superman 2, and Superman 3, right? It's kind of zany, the Bond level villain sort of stuff going on. The difference is Donner approaches it with reverence. He treasures his childhood. He looks back on it with love and affection. And so, you know, the original Superman is a great film, but it's also a great tribute to the memories of childhood and our great heroes and those sorts of things. Whereas this is, and you mentioned, you know, this is the first big budget, you know, superhero franchise. And so it establishes that third time you strike out, but like, it is amazing. The trajectory with the later Batman films is incredibly similar, right? Because you have the first Batman, the second Batman is kind of like, well, yeah, this is mostly what I like, but it's not quite as good as I wanted it to be and all of that sort of thing. And then you hit the third one. And I think at the time with this too, there's this momentum in the audience. You have enough goodwill carrying you through that people sort of glance over and they talk about Freaky Robot Lady and... you know, Superman fighting Superman, and oh, hey, Richard Pryor's a big star. He's busting out right around this time. Of course, hey, Richard Pryor's always funny. And so I think people bring a lot of goodwill into it, just like they did with Batman Forever. And then, you know, eventually you get to the fourth one, and everybody's like, wait a minute, no. What happened? You know, you sort of wake up from the fever dream sort of thing. But yeah, the opening credits are like, and especially going back and watching it for this, I'd forgotten how just underwhelming those credits are, because Like with a Superman movie, you're like, you know what? No matter what, I'm going to have that rousing theme. I'm going to have that incredible thing. And then that happens. And I'm just like, what? And I mean, it's this huge Rube Goldberg happening of like, you know, somebody trips and hits a thing and looks at a woman and falls over and hits a guy with a hot dog. And like, and then the guy goes into and hits a fire hydrant and starts drowning in his own car because he can't open the door. You know, like...
Well, it's like a, I don't know, like a slapstick comedy skit that just goes on, and there's like the dogs get, you know, chasing penguins that set on fire, and then blind people grab street painters instead of their seeing eye dogs, and, you know, hot dog stands are blood. I'm like, what is this? Like, what? This is not how this is. And not only that, you didn't even start out with this. You start out with like Richard Pryor at the unemployment office, and yes, then we cut to this. So, yeah, so Richard Pryor's in this, right? And Richard Pryor being Superman 3 makes me so happy that, you know, being the Star Trek fans we are, John, we all know of the near misses of celebrities in Star Trek movies we had. Most famously, you know, Eddie Murphy in Star Trek 4, right? Huge, yes, Star Trek fan. Everybody's like, oh, we're going to get Eddie Murphy in Star Trek 4. Didn't work out. They wrote a part for him. It just didn't work out for whatever reason. I love Eddie Murphy. I think he's hilarious. I think he's a great actor as well. He's... kind of that kind of trajectory a lot of comedians do, where they do like more serious roles later in their career and get like the acclaim for the talents they are later on. Would have not been a good fit for Star Trek 4, because then it'd be like, oh, it's the one with Eddie Murphy, right? Instead of the one with the whales, it'd be the one with Eddie Murphy, right? Yep. So it just because someone is a fan of something doesn't mean they need to be like part of something. And as I understand it, as the story goes, Richard Pryor was on The Tonight Show talking about like he'd love to be in a Superman movie, right? And apparently Sal Kine saw this and were like, oh, let's get him. That's great. That's good business. And they did. And here we are. And, you know, Richard Pryor didn't really like the script, but they paid him like, you know, a ton of money at the time. And so he accepted it. And there he was. Right. I mean, there was talk initially of like, oh, they're going to do Brainiac. They'll bring in Supergirl. They'll do Mr. Mixpedelec. Right. And all these grand ideas. But that kind of went to the wayside. One, for budget. Two, for, oh, let's tap into the popular culture and do Richard Pryor. Mm-hmm. So it's like, okay, man, that was not the right decision, because, I mean, Richard Pryor is just a funny stand-up comedian, right? But I don't want to see Dave Chappelle in Man of Steel 2, right? So I don't want to see Richard Pryor in Superman 3.
Well, know? let's not get ahead of ourselves here, because some of us might be open to seeing Dave Chappelle in Man of Steel 2, because why not? But the Richard Pryor thing, and I think you hit on it right there when you mentioned, you know, the Sal Kine see it, and they're like, oh, hey, this is a good bunny move. We'll get people, you know, into the theater and everything. That, again, I think shows why there was such a clash with Donner behind the scenes, is because, again, he's trying to create something memorable and lasting, and they're just trying to make a buck.
Yeah, flavor of the week. Yeah.
Right. Yeah, they want to put butts in the seats. That's it. That's all they care about. And it makes a perfectly smart move. And, again, you have that same trajectory with the Batman movies. Right,
Jim Carrey.
There you go.
So, what have we talked about this ever? Like, what's your thoughts on Batman Forever, real quick?
I tipped my hand earlier. There was a lot of goodwill and momentum from the first two Batman movies, and so, including myself, saw the third one. It was like, yeah, get the glasses from McDonald's. Yeah, this is fun. This is cool. And then rewatch it like a year later, and it's like, this is terrible. What happened? And then Batman and Robin just sort of like teased out everything about Batman Forever that I didn't like and bubbled it up to the surface.
The thing with Batman Forever and me, I mean, we say this because that's the third Batman movie, this is the third Superman movie, because there are comparisons to be drawn there. I didn't even really think about Jim Carrey and the Richard Pryor. That's really A to B, what's going on there. I love Batman Forever still because of, I was the perfect age when that came out. I was 8 years old when Batman Forever came out. So that was like the blockbuster of my youth, right? I mean, there was that. Before that, Jurassic Park, and then the Star Wars Special Editions and Godzilla, right? I mean, those are the movies that like were my, you know, blockbusters. And so I look back with such fondness and nostalgia, and it is fun. But yeah, Batman Forever, much better than Superman 3. But I think
yes,
there's a separation there as well, right? If Michael Keaton had been in Batman Forever and it had been the way it was, it might have kind of pulled everything down with it, but there's a clear break between Returns and Forever, where it's like everything is different, right? There's except for Alfred and Gordon, everything is different. Music, yeah. Stars, aesthetic, storytelling style. But here, Christopher Reeve's Superman, they're using the John Williams themes, right? The Daily Planet, the staff, like everything is. This is intricately tied to the first two. I mean, there is a little bit of a separation, but I think that helps the Batman movies, like, because people still look back with fondness, you know, on Batman and Batman Forever. And people, of course, people look back with fondness on Superman and Superman 2. That's why Bryan Singer made Superman Returns, you know, like a sequel to those, sort of. And, you know, in the last episode, we covered Superman Returns, and this is the other Superman 3, the original Superman 3. Where do you fall on it, John? What is Superman 3 for you? Is it this, or is it Superman Returns?
Oh, Superman Returns, hands down. That's my Superman 3. And it's, it's interesting because I guess age does play into it, but I mean, I was technically the quote unquote right age for Superman 3 when it came out. And no, this is like complete swing and a miss. I would have been younger when Superman 3 came out. But I don't know. There's just a fundamental unseriousness. And the thing is, I'll go ahead and say it. There's a fundamental sloppiness to how Lester approaches the work. I actually had reason recently, because it was free on Amazon Prime and I love disaster movies. There was a film called Juggernaut, and it's directed by Richard Lester. It's from the 1970s, and it's about the Britannic, and an Irish terrorist plants a bomb on board. Richard Harris plays, you know, a bomb expert who has to, you know, eventually go on and, like, you know, beat the guy, you know, at his own game sort of thing. He builds these great bombs. Omar Sharif is in it. You got all of these British character actors where you're like, oh, wow, there's Anthony Hopkins when nobody knew who the hell he was. Ian Holmes. It is a cast in this movie. But just like everything else I've seen that Lester did, it's not that, like, he doesn't know where to point a camera or anything, but you just get the sense of, like, there's a workman quality to it. There's not a craft quality to it that you get with a Donner or a Burton that's going to come in and say, this is my style, this is my look, I'm going to put my stamp on this. When you sit down, you're going to know I did this. Whereas Lester, it's just sort of, it's more just a series of shots put together where it's like, yeah, okay, let's make a movie sort of thing.
Right. Well, on time and under budget, right? That's why he works so well with the Salkinds. It's so tough to analyze this stuff, because if it wasn't for the Salkinds, you wouldn't have gotten Superman the movie. I mean, they're private investors, right? I mean, no one was going to make a Superman movie without them. And so I don't want to, like, completely throw them under the bus, but they didn't understand what they had, and Richard Donner did, and that was the difference. Verisimilitude, right, is the word he always used. And that's sadly out the door when he goes out the door. And yeah, you can see the clear line between Superman 2, the Richard Lester reshoots and the things he brought to it, and just brought to its fullest extent here in Superman 3. So,
yeah, and there actually Superman 3, and I'll give Sean Eastridge credit for always bringing this up. Roger Ebert's criticism of it was, and I'm paraphrasing here, Superman 3 is the movie that everybody was afraid the first Superman movie was going to be. Like, people went into Superman sort of with an expectation that this was what they were going to get. And so when they went in and got what they got, that's another reason why it's embraced so warmly in such a landmark film, is it subverted expectations in a very good way, you know? So, and I mean, the thing is, we're barely past the credits here with this, right? And it's like, that's what makes Superman 3 so fascinating, is there's so much to talk about it because it is such a case study. And then, you know, when you reach out to and look at Batman Forever, right? This is the same studio. This is Warner Brothers. How could they not learn their lesson? Right? Like, I would love to do a study and see, you know, which executive was in which position when these movies came out. Like, did somebody not get fired that should have been, sort of thing? It just would be really interesting. But, like, you know, eventually we do get to, I guess, I think one of the really interesting tidbits about this, going back and watching it, is the same with anything else in the early 80s and stuff like that, is the first embrace of the idea of how computers were going to change the world.
Computers!
Yes. Yes.
Anything is possible. Like, you look at James Bond, you look at this, you look at War Games, Tron. I mean, like, computers were this magical, you know, thing where anything was, it really was magic, you know, at the time. And so it just, man, like, it's, but in, see, the kernel of the idea, you think, is this a leftover from Brainiac? Maybe, like, when they had an idea of Superman versus a computer? I mean, in theory, that's a decent thing to explore. But the way to go about, hey, here's a, I guess, idiot savant guy who can program computers. And they're like, there's even, like, he's even at a computer class. And he's like, and they tell him, like, no one can do that. He's like, well, I just did it. And they're like, how did you do that? He's like, I don't know. And I'm like, that's it.
Right.
That's the only explanation you get, because computers are magic, everyone.
Right. Right. And, you know, and the way they reward his accidental genius is, here's a temp job at, you know, in a basement in a building here in Metropolis. You would think that you would think that a teacher would be like, OK, wait a minute, you did something really special here. Mm-hmm. Why don't we go over to the university's labs and see what you can figure out over there? But like, but at the same time, right. Yeah. Magic box theory and all of that. But what he does with it at first that gets him exposed to this movie's version of Lex Luthor is something that we see happen, you know, in a lot of movies to this day with computers, about basically skimming money.
Office finding Space a way. Specifically yeah. references this.
Yeah. Right?
Oh, man. You know, you mentioned, and we'll come back to the computer thing as we talk, but you mentioned this movie's version of Lex Luthor. Actually, I tweeted about this, and my follow-up tweet got much more attention, which I expected, but I just threw this out there. Hot take. Ross Webster, right? Robert Vaughn, the great Robert Vaughn from Man from U.N.C.L.E. fame, and many other films, but I'm sure that's probably what his biggest claim to fame is. He was also in a lot of, I don't know, in your part of the country, if it was in these commercials, John, but Robert Vaughn used to come on like these lawyer commercials.
Oh, yes.
Yeah. Him and then Shatner also, like Shatner went to the same commercials. So, like, where do they find these guys? They go through 1960s TV shows and call these guys up. Anyway, got to keep it in context, right? This is pre-Crisis, 1983. The Crisis on Infinite Earths in DC Comics was 1986. So before then, before they based Lex Luthor off of, you know, a Donald Trump-esque character, right? Mm-hmm. A you know, billionaire, you know, mogul in the big city. Lex Luthor was a crazy mad scientist guy, right? And so that wasn't going to work for the Richard Donner universe, you know, Tom Mankiewicz, you know, the writer as well, they brought a certain sense of like, all right, how do we make this work? And so Gene Hackman is great in the first Superman movies. That's really not the Lex Luthor that I like to see, for example. But for what he's doing, he's a great job. Now, it's like a chicken and the egg thing, right? I'm like, did they base the post-Crisis Lex Luthor a little bit off Ross Webster here? Because he's like... He's really the post-Crisis right? Lex Luthor here, is he? I mean, I don't know. That's definitely the vibe I get watching it through the lens of the past.
I could see that. I think there's a compelling argument for it. And I hadn't really thought... I mean, obviously, he's this movie's Lex Luthor. But when I rewatched it, it didn't really click for me like that. But then as soon as you did tweet that, as soon as you shared it with me, you're like, by the way, hey, like, you're right. Like, I totally look at his character in a different way now, where I'm like, yeah, this is a Lex Luthor that I'm more familiar with nowadays. Like, this would be the accepted sort of version of Lex Luthor, as opposed to the purple jumpsuit wearing swamp bog inhabiting Lex Luthor.
He stole
Luthor.
50 cakes.
Right.
As the meme goes.
Yes.
Yeah, and so this is the most comic book accurate Lex Luthor we've gotten in a movie. And all the Lex Luthor. Well, I don't understand how television series get Lex Luthor so right, you know? I mean, John Shea, Michael Rosenbaum, John Cryer, these are my top three Lex Luthors. They're all excellent. They do it so well. And they go to the movies, and it's like, oh, I don't know. I mean, and Superman Returns, you know, as we talked about in the Superman Returns podcast we just did, missed opportunity of the highest degree not to transition the Donner Lex Luthor into the post-Crisis Lex Luthor. Like, that's what you do. Superman's
sure.
gone. Superman's gone for 5 years. While he's gone, Lex Luthor got out of prison. He's a genius. He started a business. He's the people love him now. like, the script writes itself. I mean, they were interested in telling other things with that story, fair enough. But to me, that's going to be the huge, biggest missed opportunity that movie ever made. But hey, here we go with Ross Webster, Websco, or whatever. I mean, it's so funny. But the thing is, it's like, well, Gene Hackman was never going to come back. Well, he came back for Superman 4. But now, he wasn't going to come back because he was mad about how they treated Richard Donner. Him and Donner had become very close, and he refused to come back for the reshoots. That's why we have stunt doubles, stand-ins, yes. and voiceover guys. You ever heard of parachutes? That kind of stuff. So that's what you get. So they're like, well, we can't use Lex Luthor. But it's funny, they didn't say, let's just make a Lex Luthor type, because this was not a Lex Luthor type in 1983. That's what I find so fascinating, that this guy became, you know, that kind of type. So he didn't come back, so they got, you know, Robert Vaughn. I think Robert Vaughn does fine here. I mean, I love some of his lines. He's like, it's like a wise man once said, I think it was Attila the Hun, it's not enough that I succeed, everyone else must fail. I'm like, it's good lines. And like, he's, as you said, a Bond villain, right? I mean, he would be a great Bond villain.
He would, and well, I mean, and having the ski jump, well, not ski jump, the ski hill on top of his building is, right. But again, you know, that's the sort of thing, though, that they indulged with Donner's stuff as well. You know, the underground lair beneath the subway and stuff like that. So I actually like the stuff like the artificial ski slope, because that is sort of the crazy excess of the wealthy. You know, I mean, the 80s, everybody forgets the 80s was, you know, had that show Lifestyles of the Rich and Famous with Robin Leach. Right. And it was always about like how ostentatious could people make their stuff. And so like this is completely, you know, it's exaggerated, but it's completely in line where it's like you could see a rich guy, you know, going a little bonkers and building his own ski slope on top of a building. And actually the, like, you know what, as much as I enjoy sort of like curb stomping Superman 3, like the production design and the set decoration for his office is pretty great.
Yeah, that's a like huge set.
Yeah, and you can actually tell a lot about his character from that, which is like the whole point of production design. Mm-hmm. So like, I actually like what they did there with that. And I think that, also, it's something to hold on to because, you know, it's that little piece of what you like floating around in there. And so it makes sense that we would gravitate toward and latch on to it. Sort of like, yes, this is what I can float on.
Well, it's interesting that they use this template they had made for Lex Luthor. Like, all right, Lex Luthor has... What is it? The villains of the Superman movies, just like a set. There's always a set of three of them. And all the Christopher Reeve movies, right? In the first movie, it's, you know, it's Lex, Otis, and Miss Tessmacher, right? Mm-hmm. And it's Zod, Ursa, and Non. Here it's, you know, Webster. I guess he has a bigger crew here, but it's Webster, his sister, and his girlfriend, who is also a genius but hides it, which I don't... Why is that in there? I don't know. I think they're trying to say something, but it amounts to nothing.
No, I wouldn't give them that much credit.
And then there's this whole thing about how everybody, like, you know, makes fun of his sister for being, I don't know, homely, to say it politely. I don't
know. I'd say that, yes. She's... Yes. They're not overly kind.
No. I'm like, no. There's nothing wrong with the camera, Chief. She just looks that way. I'm like, damn.
Yeah,
yes. although I will say I genuinely laughed because it was understated humor when Richard Pryor was up there. He's like, "Come on, man!" And she's like, "Don't call me man." He's like, "You know when you're in the men's room and you're using that," and she just gives him this look. I'm like, "All right, I see what you're saying here." But that part was humorous to me. But yeah, so you have this crew of villains, and then of course in Superman 4 you have Lex, Lenny Luthor, who goes on to play Lex Luthor, John Cryer in the Arrowverse, and the Nuclear Man. So there's, anyway, these sets of three, I don't know why they needed to do that. You know, just like, they figure that's the template. You know, perhaps because James Bond villains always have a henchman, and then perhaps a femme fatale, right? Because that's what they're doing here, right? Because, what's her name? Laurelie? She's like Miss Tessmacher 2.0 to a degree, so that's what they're going for, I guess.
But I think it's also really interesting because you mentioned how, you know, it's similar to Bond villain and stuff like that. And yes, they do have sort of that the Bond girl moment where she's trying to seduce Superman, right. And which is just it's really an uncomfortable scene to watch. It's really just you almost get this aura coming off of Christopher Reeve that's like even he doesn't want to be there, where it's like, can we just get this scene over with, please? And it's just, you just want to hit fast forward, but she's obviously in there for, you know, for that scene, to have that revolve around and underline, you know, the Superman I know wouldn't be hanging out with some floozy. But it's really, you're right, it is really odd. Like, in terms of her hiding her genius or whatever, I think that's just a throwaway punchline, you know, that for whatever reason is in there. I don't think they're trying to say anything, right. Any societal commentary, as it were.
Well, you mentioned the 80s, right? And it's like, you know, excess money was everywhere, right? It was the 80s. And it's like there's some attempt... Or someone at some point said, oh, we should act like we're making a statement here, right? Because we have this opulence of the rich, but then they have the oil crisis, you know, which was fresh off the 70s. This is on people's mind. Then there's like a scene like the everyman in the bar, like, man, whenever something like this happens, it's a little guy who suffers. Somebody's profiting off of this. And then you have like the juxtaposition of, you know, small town Smallville, and we'll get to that here. But again, I think it's just... There's no greater thought put into it. It's just kind of there. I think, you know, don't give it too much credit, right?
You know, you mentioned Smallville, though. I have to go there because I have to ask, because you are such a Superman fan and everything. Lana Lang versus Lois Lane.
Yeah, let's do it. Let's get there.
Let's go.
My other hot take, rewatching this movie, and I've always had this vibe. Perhaps because, you know, being the Smallville fan I am, you know, I love Annette O'Toole, right? I'm predisposed to like her. You know, in the Christopher Reeve movies, this is the only version of Superman, I will subscribe to this, but in the Christopher Reeve movies, I feel like the relationship between Clark and Lana is better than Clark and Lois. And
Bingo.
You seem to agree with me.
I do. My man. I do. I always
they're coming
like
after us now, John. Batten down the hatches.
Oh no, we're in trouble. That is, you know, we talk about stuff we remember from kids, you know, the robot lady and Superman fighting himself. I always remember, even as a kid, responding to the romance between Clark and Lana, because it felt that there just felt like there was more chemistry there. I'm not saying that to say that there was anything wrong with anybody's performance in the first two or anything like that. I'm just saying that it seemed as if her presence breathes some life into that aspect of Superman. Because in a sense, if I'm to come down on, especially Superman 2, I wouldn't hit on this in Superman the movie so much. But like in Superman 2... the relationship with Lois feels almost obligatory. Like, yeah, okay, it's Lois Lane. Let's do this. We know what we have to do, and it's going to happen. Whereas this felt like a truly natural and organic outgrowth of the character.
Well, I think it's helpful that everybody knew, like, I say everybody, right? Well, no, Lana Lang was in the first film, right? These are not the same. Right. You know, Jeff East played young Clark Kent. And I don't know who the actress was, but she played young Lana Lang in the first film. They go to Clark goes to his high school reunion in this film, which is the excuse to get him back to Smallville. Of course, we get the pictures of them, you know, Christopher Reeve and Ed O'Toole in high school instead, but whatever. Right. I I'll come around to what we're talking about, but I did find it amusing that apparently being invited to your high school reunion is a great story for the Daily Planet. I didn't understand that. Set, like, he has to sell it, you know, and he's like, oh, I think it's an amazing story, and oh, kid here has been invited to his high school reunion. Hey, I'm like, what do you mean? It's Smallville. It's like 30 people that are invited to this. So but I think, you know, and we can wrap back around to what we're talking about here with Lois Lane, right? So Margot Kidder was a big supporter of Richard Donner, as was Christopher Reeve. Christopher Reeve almost didn't come back for this. They had almost cast Tony Danza as Superman to replace him. I know last time we talked, John, you were talking about seeing costume tests of other actors, perhaps. This might have been what you were talking about. Because Reeve was not pleased with how they treated Donner either, but they gave him a lot of money, and, you know, so they, because they're like, we can't pull a Val Kilmer here, you know, Superman right. doesn't wear a mask, you know. Val Kilmer, you know, if you squint, he looks a lot like Michael Keaton under the cowl, right? He's got the same kind of, like, I don't know, lip and jaw structure, I don't know, but you can't hide that with Superman. So, they worked the things out with Reeve, but with Margot Kidder, they basically, like, she's barely in the movie. Like, she has a cameo, a glorified cameo at the beginning and end, because she goes on vacation throughout the whole movie. And so they're like, well, there's no Lois Lane. What do we do? Well, Lana Lang, right? And I'm like, oh, that makes sense. That's even outside of the comic books, she's been established in this continuity, right? We had the high school moment with him with Superman back in the first film. So to come back to that, right? You don't have to see as much, because we talk about the romance. It's just a sweet interaction of two characters that care about each other. It's not really a romance, I guess, in a way. But you just kind of like say, oh, there's a past there that they're rekindling, right? And, you know, making her like, kind of, I love all their dialogue, because she's kind of scatterbrained, and they're always like kind of, they're on the same wavelength, but they're not. Like when they're cleaning up after the, the reception, and they're talking about mayonnaise and divorce and all kinds of stuff like that. But they're connecting, but not connecting. And it's, I don't know, it's very cute, and it's very nice. And I don't know, like I just really like the relationship between them. And so we spent the first half of this conversation just talking trash about this movie. But I genuinely love Lana Lang in this, and I really love Clark and Lana's relationship, because you get to see a side of Clark you didn't see in the first two, because it's like, they're super mad, right? There's like Kal-El talking to Jor-El, then there's bumbling Clark Kent. But you're like, who is the real personality? This is pre-crisis, so Superman's the real personality, but is he really? Because he's kind of putting on an air. But this is just Clark being Clark, and there's something charming. But when she calls him on the phone and he smiles, like, I don't know, it's charming. I like it, all right? So just going to say it. He gives her a ring at the end. Okay, so to me, just forget Superman 4. This is how it ends. He didn't want to get married or something, I guess. I don't know.
Yeah, I think that it's an example of something succeeding despite itself.
Mm-hmm.
I think that, you know, Christopher Reeve showed up to work, and I think that Annette O'Toole, I mean, you know, imagine the big break this is. You're going to be in the new Superman movie. And so she brings her A-game. He brings his A-game. There's actual chemistry between them, and I think they make it. Again, it's one of those things where it's like, oh, this is a good thing in here. I shall hold on to it. I shall preserve it in my brain and forget that Richard Pryor drives up as an army general to hand a briefcase over to somebody middle of a thing in Smallville.
Interesting that, in the other Superman 3, Superman Returns, his love interest is a single mom. Well, not really a single mom, but kind of. There's a child character named Ricky here and Richard there. Or, no, Richard's the Richard's the dad. Jason. Yeah. All right. So that's an interesting point of unintentional symmetry between the two of them. The kid is kind of annoying, honestly. I don't know if it's the dubbing, because they dub a lot of these kid actors. It's like, oh, I was looking for da-da-da. That's how they all sound. Ricky's kind of annoying, I'm not going to lie. But I love, and you know, we can, you know, these dovetail these together. I love Christopher Reeve's performance in this. As much as we've been dogging on the movie, right? Now we're in like our positive area. For now, something will come up, I'm sure.
Quickly derail.
But I love Reeve in this. I think, you know, they say James Bond, right? Well, all the James Bond, we keep seeing, there's a lot to compare with James Bond here. James Bonds, they usually hit their stride in third film. That's what the common consensus is. And you nodding in agreement, it's you agree. Goldeneye, Goldfinger.
Yeah, I knew what you meant.
Goldeneye being the third Timothy Dalton, of course. No, The World Is Not Enough for Brosnan, right? I love The World Is Not Enough, by the way. Hot take.
Denise Richards
is the weak point, but everything else I love.
I'm going to have to back out of agreeing with you here. I really have to back out of this one, because I'm sitting here nodding. I'm like, yeah, this makes no.
What's Roger Moore's third one, John?
Roger Moore's third one would be, is that Spy Who Loved Me? Is that going to be his third one? That's one of the greatest Bond films ever created. But Connery's greatest, I mean, in my opinion at least, is From Russia with Love. Mm. I think that's his finest hour, and so I think that movie's incredible.
We're totally wrong about all these things. Okay. Yeah. I don't know why that's a... It's like the Star Trek odd even rule. It's like, for some reason, it's become a thing, but it's not accurate. So maybe take that all back. The idea, though, is that when an actor has played a character, you know, two or three times, like they're in the role now. They figured it out. They're comfortable. They're free to kind of like, you know, make it their own. So that's the idea of that, you know, common consensus, which is apparently very incorrect. But Reeve here is excellent, right? I mean, his Clark, we haven't seen more of his Clark like this before, and that he's like somewhat assertive Clark, you know, more so than bumbling idiot. He can be quote unquote himself when he's with Lana. That's great to see. We see so many shades of Reeve here because we see him as Superman as we know him, and then we see him as evil Superman, which is, you know, the standout thing in the film as well. That whole, it makes, don't get me wrong, it makes no logical sense. It's never explained, nor that even attempt to explain it. But, you know, it's very memorable. And to see all these shades of his performances are great. And man, the man never looked better as Superman either. I mean, he looks incredible as Superman. And it's a shame that such an amazing performance, an amazing physique that he put a lot of work into is wasted on this kind of movie.
Yeah, and getting to the thing that's tough about the whole good Superman, bad Superman arc, you know, you're absolutely right. It doesn't make any sense. And there's no real attempt to have any real sort of context. It's just about having that moment, about having that. And I realized as I was watching it this time that my biggest problem with that whole aspect of the film is it's predicated on this Manichaean idea, oh, we're all split. We're all a good person and a bad person. Mm. Good and evil, perfect balance. It's a light side of the force, dark side of the force, must be in perfect balance, blah, 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 right? But Superman doesn't have that, right? There's nothing to support in the character up to this point that he's got some sort of dark, fiery, awful side in him. That's like, he's the incorruptible. He's... like, the whole reason everybody loves Superman is because he's the good guy. He's just inherently the good guy. He's proof that there are people who are good down to their core. And then in this movie, as neat as an idea as it is of, you know, Superman versus Superman, there's, I know it's Superman 3. I know, oh, you're taking a comic book movie awfully seriously, but I look at it in terms of character development and I think, this doesn't make sense just in terms of Superman. Mm-hmm. This doesn't speak to him. He doesn't have that part of himself. That's why we love him, because he's a reminder that there are good, wonderful people out there that don't have any sort of ulterior motive. This would suggest that Superman is always keeping that evil, that Zod side of him contained and under control. I don't like that.
You mentioned Zod there. They use the Phantom Zone criminal theme for the evil Superman and everything he does, which is odd to me because Ken Thorne, you know, did the music on these two films and they reuse so many John Williams cues. To your point about the opening credits, not wanting to use it, that's interesting. But then they use everything else. Like, I don't know if they didn't want him to write new music or if they were afraid to deviate, but it's like that's the issue with, I think, these two scores is they have the same cues, the same ways, just not as well orchestrated in those recordings. It's just over and over.
Well, I don't know how it works.
Yeah.
But my understanding would be, number one, Williams costs money by that point.
Yeah.
Number two, he's probably busy on a couple of other projects because he's, you know, in the midst of his Lucasfilm. And my God, because this is right around the time where he would have been composing...
Return of the Jedi.
Jedi, but he would have been coming right off of E.T.
Oh, man.
And he's going into Temple of Doom, and he's coming off... like, he's busy at this point. And so there probably were scheduling problems, but also money. He's going to be a more expensive composer by this point because you're paying for the guy who did Superman, ironically enough, and Star Wars, and Close Encounters, and... Raiders of the Lost Ark. Like, he's the name in film scoring by this point. And, you know, so it'd sort of be like getting Hans Zimmer today, where it's like, I want Hans Zimmer to do the score. It's like, well, you're going to pay for it. So I think that there's a probably a payment thing. And I think that there's probably something about reorchestrating it probably makes it cheaper as well.
Yeah, you know, absolutely. Like, yeah.
Because you're re-recording it. You're not using the actual cue, you know, like, and so, et cetera, et cetera. I don't know. I don't know that if anybody knows the specific mechanics, feel free to reach out to us.
Let us know. Please. You know, what's funny, John, is that he did Jaws 2, but not Superman 2.
We all make choices with our lives, Zach.
As I understand it, though, I don't know where I read this, but it was John Williams initially was going to do Superman 2, but he had a meeting with Richard Lester, and then he left and he said, I cannot work with that guy. That I heard that, read that. I'm not sure where, considered apocryphal, but that's a story I heard at some point on the internet researching the Superman things that I do. But yeah, tying that back into Evil Superman, you know, here's a fun fan theory for you, John. I know we love headcanon. That's part of our fun, being fans. Yeah. So, you know, in Superman Reversed Time, in Superman the movie, right, he went back in time, there were two Superman. Perhaps they merged together, and this tar kryptonite is what separated the two of them. And not being able to, you know, mentally sustain himself, much like Captain Kirk and the Enemy Within. You know, the two Supermen need each other, you see, because one represents the assertive, animalistic side, and the other represents the more subdued, intellectual side, the Clark Kent, if you will. So the two must battle it out.
I have to admit that I'm in awe of how much heavy lifting you just did with that. Sure. Okay, I'll go with it. Okay.
I wanted to mention that at some point in my life, and I'm glad that this has given me the opportunity to do so.
I think that is one of the most creative fan theories I've ever heard in my life, and so as a result, I have to subscribe to it.
There we go.
That works for me.
It's canon.
So. Yes.
No, it's cool. Why does the suit get darker though? Is it because it's dirty? I don't know why it gets.
The tar. Tar.
Oh.
Oh, okay. Tar stains your teeth and it stains your lungs. Therefore, his suit is stained because he comes from inside regular Superman.
Very good.
So that he passes through the tar from the cigarette.
Very good. See, we're playing fan theory ping pong here. But you know what's interesting is when they made Superman Returns, they apparently used the wrong still of Christopher Reeve to base the costume off of because it's the colors of the evil Superman suit.
See, I always thought that was just like a bold sort of like, you know, embrace of just like having a richer color pattern sort of thing, I guess. But like, it is always strange to me that people are so reticent to just go for the bright colors of Superman, right? Like, Batman dresses the way he does because he's at night and he's troubled and all of that jazz. Superman is supposed to be bright day colors. He's supposed, like, Superman isn't hiding from anybody. Superman isn't trying to blend into the shadows. Superman declares his presence and it's just like, I'm not afraid of you, therefore we shall fight, you know, that sort of thing. So I don't understand why people would be reticent to embrace the brighter color scheme of his suit. But
well, people are like, oh, it sticks out. That's the point. Like, you look at the Superman the movie, he's the fantastical element that exists in the real world, so it makes perfect sense and it's great. And when they shy away from that, I don't know. But here, it's like, oh, he's evil. That's why he's darker now. So the costume design works. I think they do the fight pretty well, too. And the junkyard's a cool environment. The scream when he lands is reminiscent of the scream he does in Superman the movie. The hair, even, you know, his hair's all messed up and more brownish in this film than it is in the first two. I mean, Christopher Reeve had brown hair, and he had to dye his hair for the first two films. As I understand it, in this one, well, that wouldn't make any sense, because I remember reading that he wore a wig in this one because dyeing the hair made his hair fall out, so he didn't want to do that anymore. But why would the hair be more brown if it were a wig? It's almost as if they didn't have a close attention to detail when making this film, John. Surprising.
I have had enough of that, Zach. You are not going to besmirch the attention to detail on these films. No, I won't stand for that.
So yeah, the junkyard fight is fun. I mean, again, there's no like, why is this happening? Like, but it's like, oh, Clark Kent versus Superman. That's a cool idea. And then, like, Superman holds some sort of resentment towards Clark Kent, apparently, but that's never really explored. And again, kernels of good ideas here, because this is like, we have the supercomputer's like a poor man's Brainiac, and this is like a poor man's Bizarro. And it's like, why can't we just have those characters in the film? You know? It's just, But, I mean, for the, you know, to have the split screens and the stunt doubles, I think they do a pretty good job, you know, with the fight, and it's entertaining to watch Superman and Clark Kent, and the end is very visceral, right? Talk about it's like a family entertainment, right? It's 1980s, and we got Superman choking the other Superman to death.
Yes.
He disappears because he's been reabsorbed, or perhaps dispersed, because he's from an alternate timeline, as we established. And then, but he's wearing the Superman costume, the good colored one. Underneath, that's the. If you go to, seriously, I would say 75% of the time, if there's a magazine article or an internet article about Christopher Reeve or Superman, even if it's about the first two movies, it's the shot at the end of the junkyard fight of the shirt being ripped open and Reeve standing there triumphantly. Wouldn't you say, John?
Yeah, I would. Yeah, and it is like that. That's the thing that's so difficult about this, though, right? It does, I think, speak to Lester as a director. You know, there are these tableaus that work, but it's just, that's all that they are. You know, they're moments, but they're not, there's no strong attempt at the connective tissue. It's just about, you know, hitting the impulse and getting you out the door so that they can get to the next showing, sort of thing. And even the whole thing with him, you know, going on the detour and fighting himself and stuff like that could have been a really interesting thing in and of itself. And it underlines very much, I think, the needlessness of Richard Pryor.
Right.
In the terms of the movie, like, it's so, he feels so grafted on, and it never struck me until this time that I watched it. Like, he just, you know, the true essentialness of an element or a character, just, you know, like, one of the things with, like, The Force Awakens that always drives me nuts is, like, if I took out the stuff with Starkiller Base, I wouldn't miss it. Doesn't add anything. I could take Richard Pryor out of this and retweak a few things, and it's like, yeah, I wouldn't really miss him. So it doesn't really stand out as how unnecessary he is as a driver to the story until it gets to that junkyard fight, because you have that moment, you have that tableau of like, oh, this is an interesting sort of thing. Like, you know, you have the femme fatale. You could add a whole movie about Superman fighting this inner urge, whatever split him for whatever reason.
Yeah.
And you have good Superman off with Lana, and you have bad Superman off living the bad boy, and you have this big momentous moment of like, no, I know who I am, you're not me, and, you know, big triumphant conquering your dark side sort of thing. And instead it's just a throwaway moment that's facilitated by, I mean, honestly, it's just ridiculous.
Well, there's a good 30 plus events. Minutes left in the film at the end of the junkyard fight. I'm like, that should be your emotional climax. Like, it writes itself. Again, like, I don't feel like we're Monday morning quarterbacking here. I feel like, no, this just makes sense. Yeah. Like, your strongest asset is Christopher Reeve as Superman. Just make him the villain and the hero. And because, like, in the first movie, he fights man. In the second movie, he fights Krypton. In the third movie, he fights his greatest enemy, himself.
Yeah, so, there you go.
What we want here was Logan, John. That's what...
but it really is, I think, also an offshoot of the fact that I think that in different hands it could have had the expression that we're talking about, that very satisfying expression. But you have hit this build of, and it's the whole reason that we got Nuclear Bizarro Doomsday Man in Batman versus Superman, right? Is like, who can take out Superman? He has, you know, he's reversed time in the first one. He's beaten three other Kryptonians in the second one. What's left, right? What could
the
possibly...
magic of computers, John?
Yes, exactly. but even that, right? Like, have Richard Pryor be this computer genius and have your low budget Brainiac, and then have that be the thing that splits Superman. because
it the computer.
Out. Yeah, well, right, but and the computer figures out is like it, I can't take him out. He's going to destroy me, so I'll make him fight himself. And then you have like this really cool sort of thing.
Oh,
and then
man!
And then Superman comes back together at the end. He's like, "Oh, SOB, right? You're the problem." And like he shows up, and you can even seed enough for a sequel because a motherboard is like left off in the corner. The, and Richard Pryor picks it up.
The Terminator Genesis post-credit scene.
Yes. Oh, I forgot about the post-credit scene.
Oh my goodness gracious! No, oh man, yeah. It's just that's what you look back on these when you think so much missed opportunity. You know, it's just unfortunate because you had Christopher Reeve as Superman, and it was so good. Oh man, but that's the weird thing, right? He turns evil, but then he's just doing like I'm gonna straighten the Tower of Pisa, I'm gonna blow out the Olympic torch, like such silly things. But I will say this, you know. Coupling this with like, you know, evil Superman as a concept is the strongest thing in here. I think we can agree on that.
Yes.
And we both love Clark and Lana and Lana Lang's role in this. Well, you know, talking about the acting, right? The most unsettling scene of evil Superman is the first time it hits him, the tar kryptonite. Well, yeah, let's talk briefly. They want to make kryptonite. They can't do it. Richard Pryor decides that there's a certain percentage of kryptonite which is unknown, which makes sense because it's not from this earth. So he's smoking because it's the 80s and everybody was smoking. He looks at his pack of cigarettes. He says, "Oh, what the hell, tar?" So they give him some tar kryptonite, and it does nothing to him at first. But everyone misremembers this as red kryptonite. By the way, it's not.
Really?
It has similar effects. Yeah, people are like, "Oh, it's like if you read like you know illy researched articles online, like whoa, red kryptonite, like in Superman 3, like when red kryptonite came on Smallville." Everybody was like, "Oh yeah, it's like in Superman 3, the red kryptonite." And he was like doing bad stuff. It's like, no, that's not no. But
right.
Again, the original Superman movies use green way too much. Green for the green crystal, green for the fake kryptonite, green for everything.
Yes,
but I guess if the kryptonite didn't come out green, they'd be like, "Well, we can't even give this to him." it's useless. But anyway, that's where the kryptonite comes from. Richard Pryor makes it and it doesn't work, and he gives it to him like a terrible general joke about plastic and how your butts are on plastic and. But anyway, nothing seems to happen at first, and then he's at Lana's house, and they're just like, oh, they're just hanging out, and you know, a phone call comes in, and Lana's like, oh, Superman, there's an 18-wheeler, it's about to fall off a bridge, and he's like, ah, it's fine, I always get there in time, let's hang out for a while, and they sit down on the couch, and like puts his arm around her, and he's, it's very sinister, and he's like, well, it's, you know, it's not often that you find an attractive lady like yourself alone like this, you're like, whoa, this is getting, like, this is genuinely uncomfortable.
Right.
And they it's very subtle too. I think they put just a little bit of eyeshadow. They do like the Enemy Within thing with Captain Kirk. They just a little bit of eyeshadow on him. But she's like, shouldn't you go? And he eventually kind of snaps out of it and goes. But that was the most effective evil Superman scene, I think, because it's just Superman shouldn't be doing that, and it makes you feel bad that he like something's wrong. You know. So.
Yeah, and it is also unsettling because of the whole it is such a throwaway line. It's maybe a little too self-aware when he says, I always get there in time.
Yeah.
You know, it's sort of, because that's sort of a criticism that people have of the character on occasion, which is like, yeah, he, you know, I mean, they basically, you know, if he is traveling at the speed of light and able to do all of these things, why does he even bother changing his costume? Just go, and he's done, sort of thing. But, yeah, I mean, yeah, but the thing is, I think that all ties in again just to that chemistry that was there between, you know, the actor and the actress is legitimate, and it makes the scene work. So, it, you know, again, it's something that works in spite of itself.
Mm, yeah, and Lana likes Clark more than Superman. You know, but that's right? Another charming thing about her, because when, like, Superman has to cancel and Clark shows up. He's like, "Oh, you settled for me?" And she's like, "Oh, well, even better, right?" And that's where the character has become. There's a lot of post-crisis ideas in this pre-crisis movie with the Ross Webster as Lex and Lana liking Clark because Clark's the real person. Because now in the comics, the thing is post-crisis has been like Clark Kent is the real personality. You know, he wants Lois Lane to fall in love with Clark Kent, not Superman, right? But this is pre-crisis. We can't judge this Lex and this Lois and for those kinds of things. But watching it through this post-crisis lens, there's a lot of ideas here that connect with me. And, you know, and I like, and, you know, Annette O'Toole said, you know, when you know, she had filmed most of her scenes with Clark Kent, right? And the one scene where, you know, Superman, you know, saves Ricky, right, from the tractor, which Ricky found a rock in the middle of a field and managed to knock himself out.
Yeah, when we were talking about it earlier, I was like, "What? How did that kid trip and hit himself like that?
Managed to find the one rock in the field.
But it's also, but the thing is, that rock is big enough, like that thresher is coming.
It's going to,
you know, it's going to destroy the blades on that thing. It won't save the kid necessarily, but like that field is really in bad shape when you think about it. But like, how did he even, it happened so suddenly too, because they're just like, oh, okay, he's out playing with the dog. And then all of a sudden the kid's knocked out. And it's like, I didn't even get a shot of the kid tripping, you know, like. At least
where's the connective tissue, Lester?
Exactly.
You know, Superman lands, and Ed O'Toole said that's the first time she saw Christopher Reeve as Superman. She's like, wow, it's Superman. Like, you know, even the actors in the moment are like, what? This is a totally different guy. It's so impressive, right? And just seeing, you know, seeing Superman, seeing full Christopher Reeve in his 1980s glory in the Superman suit in these mundane situations is just cool too. Like, he's in a field. He's at, you know, he's in a cave, right? He's at a parade, right? I'm like, it's just cool to see Superman like that, you know? And that's why, like, you know, Superman TV shows are fun, you know, that all the way, you know, even, you know, Lois and Clark and stuff, he'd be in situations like that. We're giving Superman the key to the city, right? I like to see stuff like that in live action as opposed to, you know, world-ending crazy stuff. And there's something quaint about Superman 3 in moments. Obviously, it's very flawed, don't get me wrong, but it's day in the life of Superman. I don't know. I mean, I don't know where to pin it down. I guess the supercomputer was eventually going to destroy the Earth or something, but it just feels like the stakes are a little lower this time for various various reasons, I guess.
Yeah.
So, man.
Yeah. And that is the thing too, is that ending. It just seems so, I don't know. There's not even any real, I don't know. There's no real peril.
Lana and Ricky were trapped in that subway, John.
Yeah, okay.
And the gas price, the stoplights, the people, the green and red stoplight guy was fighting himself, much like Superman.
Yes, yeah, exactly. And they, oh my gosh, yeah, that oil slick where it blows everything back. I mean, again, these are all, you know, Silver Age comics.
Freezes a lake to put out a fire.
Right.
Amazing.
Yes. It, right.
He take that, physics. Picks up a,
yes, he makes, and makes it rain. Yeah. I mean, sure, right? You know, it's like, okay, you know, this is very much like a kid in the 50s is reading this sort of thing. Because those comics from the 50s included, you know, Superman shooting mini Supermen out of his fingertips at one point. And, you know, the so many of these things, Bizarro Superman, Mr. Mixoplake, like all these things are just ridiculous concepts to begin with. But again, this just lacks that sort. This is just going through the motions. It's every possible sort of issue with cramming too many ideas in, not having enough of a vision for everything, just getting it up there, getting a piece of entertainment out there. It's much more suited toward television than it is toward the movie theater. And I don't mean television in terms of like, oh, hey, this is a special on Netflix. I mean like Hulk TV movie, television sort of stuff from the 80s.
Well, John, you say that, but you forget about Chekhov's acid, because in the plastic fire, in the plastic factory fire, Superman finds this acid that is fine up until it reaches a certain temperature, and then it becomes lethal. And that's established very early in the film. And that is what Superman uses to defeat the supercomputer at the end, because it analyzes them and it said, oh, there's no danger in that thing he's hiding behind his back. But in clearly a missed special effect, when Superman uses his heat vision on it, it blows up. You know, Christopher Reeve looks at it like he's using heat vision at the end.
Yeah.
But nothing comes out of his eyes. And then it starts bubbling, and it just, that red jello just splatters all over those over those computer chips and destroys the supercomputer.
Right. So they didn't just not understand how computers worked. They didn't understand how chemical reactions worked, and they don't understand anything about physics with water. It's an old 1950s comic book in spades. But like, yeah, I mean, it's just, there's so much stuff where, you know, I think you hit the nail on the head. You have your big emotional moment. You have your payoff. You have Superman coming back to terms with himself, and he's the good guy, and the bad Superman is gone. And, oh, yeah, well, we might as well resolve this other thing that's going on as well. But the thing that's always sort of interesting, and I'm so glad that things have at least tried to move, you know, in different sorts of directions, mostly, I guess, with these sorts of movies, is like this sort of Bond villain-esque, you know, Webster, I'm going to build this computer and I'm going to do these things and I'm going to drive up the... This would be insane in a world where you knew Superman existed, because Webster has already become incredibly rich and powerful without ever running afoul of Superman. And apparently rising to this, you know, prestige without ever bothering Luthor, which is interesting in and of itself. But he's in a position to manipulate the markets anyway. He's in a position to do all of these things without ticking off Superman. And on top of that, he could have done all of this stuff without ever screwing around with Superman, right? There's no need for that. There's like all of these sorts of things. And I know, oh, well, you're applying this sort of logic to things. But because of Donner, we had crossed that threshold, right? You can't go back once you've gone through that door of establishing a real world. I'm gonna defend that Luthor from the first two, because that belongs to, you know, that sort of like crazy over the top sort of thing. And it has a place. It fits.
It's a genius plan. I've criticized the Gene Hackman interpretation of Lex Luthor. The plan is genius, because I mean, that's like, hey, I'm gonna buy up some desert and drop California in the ocean, and then my desert is not beachfront property. You're like, you know what? I mean, I don't support it. I don't agree with it, but it makes a lot. I understand it. Like, I'm like, all right, I understand what you're going for there.
Well, I mean, it's overblown, sure, but it's also playing on at the time, you know, the heightened tensions of the Cold War about nuclear Armageddon and, oh my God, what if one of these warheads gets in somebody's hands? And like, people are, you know, in the 70s, that's very much on everybody's mind still, right? Whereas this is, I don't know. I mean, this is sort of like, you're right that manipulating the oil prices plays into everybody's, you know, residual tensions about the gas crisis back in the 70s, but it doesn't have that sort of, maybe I'm just not aware of how much tension there was about it. And it just doesn't seem to fit or have as much longevity, because nuclear weapons, even now, even outside of the Cold War context, is like, those still cause great, you know, stress.
Right.
You have to be careful about who has those sorts of things, where, you know, I know I'm sort of like going all over the place, but like, you get what I'm saying, right?
Right. No, I understand. And just talking about that actually made me think of, talk about out of place, right? There's one other scene, you know, when the people get in the fight at the gas station, like some guy beats up like an old man. I'm like, God, this is, this is a little visceral here, guys. I don't know.
It's sort of like, and I don't beat up on this movie as much as other people, but yeah, when they have the fight in the gas station and everything, it's sort of like that whole thing in the opening of Justice League, in the cut that got released, where it's like, Superman's dead, and suddenly everything's the worst thing in the world.
Oh,
and
yeah,
it's like, well, I don't think everybody processes grief or stress quite that way, but okay.
Right. Well, you know, and that's the point too, right? Superman being evil, that we don't see the world's reaction to that, other than like this Time magazine cover, like with him a question mark, whatever, like, oh, a lot of these countries are outlawing Superman now because he's bad. I'm like, whoa, we just skipped over an entire movie's worth of material, like we were talking about earlier. And like, you don't see what the Daily Planet's reaction is. You don't see any supporting characters. You just see like, Superman, you're good. You can beat it, Superman. Right. Superman, you have to fight. Superman, yeah. If I were, that's what he's screaming out of frustration, hearing Ricky's voice in his head. Superman's drunk. So, man, yeah, that's a whole other thing there, but yeah, man, you know, Superman 3, it's interesting. It's just, I see missed opportunity, and I see kernels of interesting ideas, but they just, it was a different time, you know, and we've, you know, I would like to think we moved past superhero movies like this, but not really. They take different forms now. They might be a little more polished, but they're just as, you know, nonsensical and squandering of the material as this one was. And it's just a shame, because there's some gold in here, right? With Reeve and Ed O'Toole, mm-hmm. and, you know, just the concepts of, you know, evil Superman and stuff. But, and there's even something to be said for greed in the 80s and computers, like, I don't know, but because the screenwriters here, David and Leslie Newman, wrote they worked with the Salcons. They wrote Lester. They wrote Superman 2. You know, they all the sillier elements came from there. They came over and take this one. And you know, if you know Tom Wakewitz had a crack at this, perhaps he would have come up with something a little more balanced, a little more, you know, real to life and true to the character and the two movies that preceded it. This just doesn't feel good when after watching those. So, oh man, it's tough. But hey, so did Clark propose to Lana at the end? Or what was that about? What was your interpretation of that situation? Like, it's like, you know what I mean?
It's Schrodinger's proposal, you know?
That's genius.
Yes and no. Yeah.
During that whole scene that Ricky like spills his Fruit Loops and Clark goes to get on a knee and you know, it's like has the image of proposing. So then Brad, who hadn't talked about it at all, but the Whitney Fordman for the Smallville fans out there, right? This is, you know, that's pretty much what he is. The Uncle Rico, for those familiar with Napoleon Dynamite, totally based off this character. He shows up and it tries to be the end of Superman 2 where Clark gets his, the bully gets his comeuppance, but it's played for more slapstick and not as good. Of course, that was directed by Donner. This is directed by Lester. We see the difference. Oh, he got tripped and there's a bed with a spring and now he's on a cart and now he's in an elevator. I'm like, oh, that wasn't very satisfying.
Sort of like the opening.
Yes, it's exactly. It's the bookends of the film, John. Don't tell me thought wasn't put into this. I do really like Clark's interactions with Brad, though, like in the bowling scene. As dumb as that is for Superman to use a super breath to make bowling pins explode, I'm like, that's...
Yes, yeah.
Come on, Clark. But I think a line that...
A little bit of finesse.
A line that always makes me laugh, though, is Brad is like, you still here, kid? And Clark's like, well, I seem to be Brad. because that's the fun of a secret identity, John. I'm always talking about that when I talk about these movies. That's something we've lost in modern superhero TV shows and movies. The secret identity. There's so much fun to be had there. And knowing that that's Superman, but this jerk, you know, washed up high school was the greatest years of his life guy treats him like dirt. But knowing that's Superman, it's just it's just fun to see, you know? And
I agree.
We don't get that anymore.
Yeah, you know, we've sacrificed a little bit of that fun. I do hope we get back to it over time. You know, because we got the Robert Pattinson Batman coming out, and it's like, oh boy, I hope that this isn't. I like you can overdo it. Obviously, here in Superman 3, they do, but you can strike that balance. You can find it. You can make it work, and have those little winks. You know, the audience is in on the joke. That stuff is fun. You can do that.
Yeah. Got a wink in the eye and a tongue in your cheek. But it's a delicate balance, you know?
Yes.
And that's what these Superman, the first two especially, found it. There's elements of it here, but they do lose their way later on. And, you know, I just thought of one other thing I did want to mention as you were out paper talking about the end. You know, you talk about, Batman Returns. Batman, right? He gets framed for Batman Push the Princess, right? But that's never resolved. Like, I guess you just assume that they figure out that the Penguin did it, whatever, right? Never resolved, right? But Batman's always kind of an outlaw anyway, and it's not like he hasn't killed people before, especially in that universe. So
he blew a guy up with dynamite just earlier in that film.
But that guy deserved it, right? No, I don't know.
Yes. He also set a fire eater aflame with his turbine.
Have you no appreciation for dramatic irony, John? But the point is, I don't know if there was like a deleted scene or script where they're like, oh, Batman, he didn't do it, right? But that's never established. This film, Superman, he gets banned by all these countries or something. In that little short subway snippet of a scene, we see, you know, with Lana and Ricky on the subway, someone's reading a newspaper. It says, Superman, super again. I'm like, when was that written? Because this happened 10 minutes ago in a junkyard. Nobody saw this. Like, you know, but I guess is it to your credit that you realized that was a problem? So then you put that in there, or should you just have ignored it completely and just assume that the world took care of itself? I don't know. Because no one sees Superman destroy this computer either. Right? Nobody knows that he's back.
I would say that both were a misstep and unnecessary and should have been left out. But that's just my take.
Oh, man. But the ending where we began, the robot sister, right? I think why it's so effective is because there's music, right? But then it just stops. There's no music, right? It's creepy. You just hear, you know, she's screaming, and then it immediately goes to silence and just becomes like, you know, you get assimilated, right? At a time before the Borg get assimilated. Now, I wouldn't have had the ridiculous hairpiece that she has. That's, you know. But hey, as a child seeing this on television, I don't know what it is, but it terrified us all. And that could have been Brainiac now has a physical form and Superman has to fight him. Like, it's right there.
Tantalizingly out of reach.
Oh, man.
These half-realized concepts.
John, I've decided, John, thinking long and hard about it, if we ever have a time machine, I'm going to pick you up. We're going back in time and we're going to remake Superman 3 based off all the things we talked about here in this conversation. And it's going to be so much better.
I'm going to one-up you. And I'm going to go back. I'm going to make sure Donner never gets fired.
You know, that is me not seeing the forest for the trees there, John. Good call. That's why I trust your wise counsel in these matters. And that's what we'll do. So, oh, man. If Richard Donner had never left, that's a great, you know, a what if. You know, you talk about the threequel. That's why, to me, arguably Spider-Man 3 is the most disappointing movie of all time. Because there was no reason for that movie to be bad. All the directors, all the actors, right? The studio interference is what sank that trilogy. Although, you know, Spider-Man, as you've seen, he fights an evil version of himself, much like Superman does in Superman 3, after giving up his powers in the second film, much like Spider-Man does. But, you know.
Oh, my gosh. No,
if there was a Spider-Man 4, he would have fought global warming. No doubt. So.
Yeah, there's. Oh, boy.
On that positive note, John, thank you so much for revisiting Superman 3 with me. I know it wasn't at the top of your to-watch-again list, but here we are. And we'll have to do it again for Superman 4. What do you say?
I'm a completist, so fine. Oh, geez. You know what? Yeah. You know what? Let's start the insanity, as Seinfeld would say. I'll commit to Superman 4 right now. The quest for peace.
Have him on microphone. Very good.
Yes.
Very good. Well, John, always a pleasure to podcast with you. We're always finding fun reasons to get together behind the microphone. If people want to find you out there on the internet, where can they find you?
Oh, just look for Kessel Junkie. That's my nom de plume online. I'm probably more fun over on Letterboxd than anywhere else. And you can find me over on the Nerd Party Summer 2020, where I'm on a limited run show called House of Fincher, where we are going through all the works of David Fincher in anticipation of his Netflix movie Mank, which is supposed to come out on Netflix in fall 2020. And I am regularly appearing on Aggressive Negotiations, a Star Wars podcast. But we don't do, you know, like upcoming news or studio leaks or anything. We're sort of like the deep dive philosophical podcast about Star Wars, if you will. So that's where you can find me.
Very good. As for me personally, you can find me on Twitter at MoronZach. That's MoronZach. I'm also the host of another podcast, Franchise Fatigue, where we talk about movies, franchises, sequels, and when franchises get fatigued. You can find us on Twitter at Franchise Fatigue and UFP Earth. And John will be joining us behind the mic over there to talk about some of the Planet of the Apes movies coming up soon over there. So keep an ear out for that.
Ape shall not kill ape.
Ape has killed ape. And as of the podcast here, you can find us on Twitter at Always Smallville with 1S. Find us on Facebook at Always Smallville to Smallville. And you can send us an email at alwaysmallville@gmail.com, once again with 1S. All right. Well, Superman 3, not one I rewatch a lot either. You know, it is the Smallville connection, though, man. I mean, it's the most on-brand Superman movie for this podcast. I mean, it takes place in Smallville. Annette O'Toole is the lead, the romantic lead, you know? I know those are some hot takes, and it's so funny because so many people who watch Smallville were like, I wish, you know, I want Clark and Lana to be together. They should change, you know, everybody wanted that. And I'm like, no, it needs to be Lois. Whether that Lois be Chloe Sullivan or Lois Lane, that's up to you to decide. But it needs to be Lois and can't be Clark and Lana. And yet here I am talking about how Clark and Lana are the best couple in the Christopher Reeve movies. I'm such a hypocrite. We all are his fans. That's what's fun, these ridiculous opinions. But hey, when we come back for Superman 4, I can't wait to see Lana's continued adventures being Perry White's secretary and how her and Clark live happily after that huge ring he gave her. That's the largest ring I've ever seen. That is not a friendship ring. That is an engagement ring to the highest order. Oh, I don't even know if it occurred to them that, like, should we bring Annette O'Toole back? Because we'll get into it next time. But it's like they bring in another, like, love rival. Again, John, it writes itself, right?
Yep.
Clark is with Lana. Lois wants to be with Superman. It's all there. It's fine.
It's there for the taking.
Oh, we're not going to wait a year to talk about Superman 4. We're going to do that sooner than later. So
Yay.
All right. Well, there you have it, folks. We'll be back to Smallville in the not-too-distant future. We're still between seasons, so we'll have some other specials and, you know, cover some comic books, things of that nature before we jump into Season 6. But until then, always hold on to Smallville. Always Hold On to Smallville is brought to you by listeners like you. Chris Fuchs, Cavante Chillis, Dallas Hernandez, Casey Cochran, James Bandini II, Darren Kirscht, Nathan McKenzie, Tim Miller, Thomas Navin, Joe Mikendo, Steve Rogers, John Curcio, Atif Sheik, Molly Ficarella, Trayvon Brady, Mike Franz, Dylan D'Antonio, Mariana Sachi, Rachel Miller, Catherine Emmerich, Andrew Parker, James Lee, Jonathan England, Adam Sullins, Joe Michael, Nathan Rothatcher, DJ Doina, Corey Moore, Nick Ryan Magdoza, Eddie Bissell, Jim Thomas, Nicholas Fansler, Catherine Caldwell, Kathleen Holland, Will Hunt, Clunk Kent, Joey Deinberg, Tom Gerke, T. Hamill, Nicholas Coso, Jared Gibbs, Erica Flynn, Anthony Anderson, and Jasmine Magelli. Thank you so much to all these patrons, and you too can become a patron by going to patreon.com/alwaysmallville with one S. Hope to see you there.